Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio, and I'm so grateful that friends and family have survived Florida. Some of my friends are putting ice on their necks and trying to stay cold. It gets hot. It gets very hot in the houses in Florida when the power's off, so they're taking cold showers. I have friends that have survived with generators. My aunt had to evacuate, my mother told me, my sweet Aunt Margie. By the way, my Aunt Margie told me about a book, and we're having the author on Saturday, Waking Up in Heaven, Crystal McVeigh. You'll have to all tune in for that show. She says that when she was clinically dead, she went to heaven. That will be this Saturday, and that'll be 11 a.m. PST, Pacific Standard Time. I guess it'll be about 2 p.m. East Coast time. We hope to have on Amy Smith. I don't know if you can hear me, Amy Smith. We're trying to reach all across the pond to Australia. Amy Smith has an amazing story of escaping a Pentecostal charismatic cult, but the time difference and the technical stuff, we're trying to straighten it all out. So while we're waiting to try to get Amy on, I wanted to bring up something that I feel is very unhealthy that happened this week in light of the hurricanes. Very unsound teaching, preaching, saying that the hurricanes in Texas and Florida were God's judgment. And I'm going to debunk that both scripturally and logically. People that capitalize to build their ministries by, you know, preaching that God's mad at all these dear people in Texas and in California that are going through the hurricanes. We're going to see how that is just scripturally and theologically and rationally and just logically ridiculous. I know I'm not saying these people are all bad and all stupid or whatever, but I owe it to you all to share my opinion about that. And so I'll be right back. We'll talk about that in about 20 seconds, and hopefully we'll be able to get Amy on the line as well to share her amazing journey out of the Pentecostal cult in Florida. I'll be right back. Let's talk about the hurricanes. Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. We're sending lots of love and light and hugs and prayer to our friends and family in Florida. I have an aunt there. I have a cousin there. I have dear friends there. And I'm so grateful that they've made it through okay. The real priority is you, people, and you're more important than your stuff. So put your hand on your heart. If it's still beating, you're good. Put your hand in front of your mouth and blow. You still have breath. You're alive, you're breathing. And I want to say very strongly, don't believe for one second the preachers, the televangelists saying this is God's judgment. A good friend of mine in Florida said the reason these preachers blame God for and say it's his judgment is they deny weather science. They deny the effects of pollution. Many of my conservative Christian friends believe global warming is a dirty word and it's Al Gore's conspiracy and it's not true. And so we can just keep abusing our earth and our trees and our oceans and polluting, and it's not going to affect the weather. But Jesus taught us that God is our loving Father. He used the word Abba, Dada. It's Aramaic for Dada. It's like when Karis recently, our daughter, started her master's in theology at Princeton. She wrote me a real sweet note recently that said Daddy, and I said, that touched me that you still call me Daddy like a little girl. That really touched me that you said that. And that's the feeling, is God's a loving daddy, a loving Abba, a loving Dada. And I would never destroy Karis's home or Joshua's home or hurt them if I was mad. God is a loving father. And simple-minded people try to use religion to blame victims. Telling hurricane people this is God's wrath and judgment, that's like telling a rape victim you deserve that, it's your fault. This is weird weather stuff. And it's terrible that these folks are doing that. It's their twisted interpretation of the Bible. Now, you can put your comments in to me at Richard Rossi Live, or you can send it to my Facebook page, facebook.com/RichardRossiActor, or email it to Richard Rossi Live, or you can call into the studio line on your screen. And we're checking if Amy's here. Amy, you there yet from Australia? Amy, not there yet. Okay, we're trying to get across the pond to our guests. It's a little challenging. So here, Victoria writes in that someone sent me a post by a woman, Richard, who claims to be a pastor, saying the hurricane is God's wrath. This woman's on your friends list. I scrolled on her wall. She brags about having an honorary doctorate from a school. I've noticed many of these preacher types that preach bizarre things brag about their titles, like doctor, when they didn't earn a doctorate academically from an accredited college. Perhaps this is an attempt to look like they have more stature to the flock. Her name is, I won't say the name, because, yeah, they are indeed one of my Facebook friends. I don't know them in real life that well. I've met them once at a Christian TV station. I was a guest on a television program, and they were hosting a program on the same station. They're friends. We have mutual friends, and so I don't want to make this person look like a bad person, so I won't mention the lady's name. But I will debunk what she says here, because I think it is very, very unhealthy. Of course, she would disagree stridently with me, I would imagine. Victoria writes, Richard, you're one of the few highly intelligent Christians I know. As someone relatively new to the faith, could you give me feedback on her post? Here it is. Then it has her name again. And here's what the Los Angeles lady preacher says. Quote, someone posted under my prayer request for Florida that these hurricanes are not about God's wrath. Really? Sorry, but God is very angry and disappointed in America. God has been removed from schools, and crosses are being torn down at universities. Bibles are being removed. Historical monuments and statues are being destroyed. Our American flag has been burned. Our government has been hated and not supported. The hatred among our youth is off the charts. Demonstration after violent demonstration. You really want to tell me that's God's wrath not at work? Wake up, people. God is warning us. He wants us to get it together, pray and seek his face and turn from our wicked ways. Then he will heal our land. Let's humble ourselves, ask for forgiveness, and ask for his mercy now, capital letters, now. All nasty replies will be deleted. So spare it, exclamation point, in capital letters. Victoria, I'm happy to give you my thoughts on this female pastor's post. A lot of Christians do what is called anthropomorphizing of God, and this comes from the word anthropology, the study of man. So in other words, they project human or man-made characteristics on God. One person said that God created us in his image and we return the favor. So she's projecting onto God, implying that God is upset about things that she is angry and upset about. She says God's upset about the removal of historical monuments recently. And the news has been full of these Confederate heroes, you know, tearing down Robert E. Lee statues. Now, this woman is from the South, and I think she's upset about that, so she thinks God is upset about that. And the burning of the flag. Well, her God is upset about what she's upset about. That's a whole other issue about political correctness and the Civil War and all that stuff, and we could have a whole nother show about are they going too far with that. I think in some cases, yes, they are. I mean, Memphis, after screening the classic Gone with the Wind for 30 years, quit screening it. I think that's getting a little ridiculous. But what she's doing is she's projecting onto God what upsets her. And conservative Christians tend to project all of that into their anthropological concept of God, that he's upset about what they're upset about. My wife and I met at a school that thought very much this way, called Liberty University, founded by Jerry Falwell. It was one of the bastions and the founders of the religious right. They believe, as this preacher does, that God is removed from schools. He was expelled from school because we don't have mandatory Bible reading and prayers. Madeline Murray O'Hare had that landmark case in the 60s, and they no longer read. Back before I was even born, they used to read the Lord's Prayer and some scriptures at the beginning of the day in school. Now, they have a very immature and simplistic concept of God, that means God is removed from school. And theologically, that's pretty crazy. God is omnipresent and cannot be expelled from schools or anywhere. Psalm 139 is a great psalm to read about that, which says you cannot remove God from anywhere. David said, if I flee to the highest mountain, thou art there. If I lay my bed in hell, thou art there. Where can I flee from thy presence? God is, just because someone doesn't read the Our Father in a classroom. I went to a school after that was expelled, and I prayed all the time in school. And me and my friends even met in the morning and prayed in school. And I shared my faith in school. And many students and teachers pray in school. But conservative Christians are upset it's not a government-mandated prayer led by teachers. And notice the evangelist says God is upset by hurting national symbols like the Confederate monuments or the flags. And these type of Christians have a God that's very nationalistic, or in this case, perhaps even a Confederate sympathizer. She mentions the removal of monuments. But God, the true God, is not limited to any ism. We attach God to our isms, nationalism, patriotism, Catholicism, Protestantism, Pentecostalism, Catholicism. God's above all that. He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. But you won't get anywhere discussing issues with folks that feel this way because it's more emotional, it's more visceral. And it'd be like a Trump supporter and a Bernie supporter arguing, and it's very unlikely either is going to change their mind. Plus, if you notice the end of this woman's post, she said she'll delete anybody that, disagrees, or she said nasty posts. So this is a type of person you can't argue about it. I'll delete your post if you even say anything I don't like. But that's all part of what this person wrote. But the overall theme of what she wrote is that God's mad, God's wrath, God's angry at these people. God, and that's not true. She doesn't understand the fullness of Christ's redemption. In 1 John 2, it says, Jesus is the propitiation for our sins, and not for our sins only, but for the sins of the whole world. The word propitiation theologically means literally the removing of all wrath and judgment. Our Florida friends are scared. They need comfort. They need support. They need prayer. They need love. It's hard now after the storm to rebuild, to clean up. They don't need someone telling them God's mad and it's God's wrath. Terrible stuff. Terrible stuff. M. Scott Peck is a brilliant Christian psychiatrist, and he talks about different stages of spiritual growth. And he talks about those that have a very childish view of things. It's like when my grandmother was alive, my mom's mom, she used to tell me when I hear the thunder, the angels are bullying, and one of them got a strike, you know. And so some of these folks, they don't accept science, they don't accept global warming, they don't accept the damage we've done to the earth that's causing a lot of these things. So, it's demons. One Christian person even is posting that it's demons, that there were these demons that caused Katrina, and the same demons, the people that had the demons that caused Katrina moved to Texas, and then they went to Florida, and they have this whole theory about these really satanic people whose demons are causing all this. But M. Scott Peck has these different stages. Stage one is a chaotic, disordered, reckless person like a young child. They defy and disobey, and they don't want a will greater than their own. Stage two, and this is where the person that wrote this, I believe, is at. Many religious fundamentalists are in stage two. Everything's black and white. Don't question God's existence. Don't question what I say. God's telling me this. The Holy Spirit's telling me. I know I'm right. They're very law-abiding. You don't question the president. You don't question the authority. This is where a lot of the fundamentalists are at. Stage three is a person that is willing to ask questions, is willing to challenge the black and white thinkers. They want things to make sense spiritually, but also logically, scientifically. They're not so fundamentalist. That's the stage three person. Stage four is the mystic, the person that really goes very deep spiritually. They see the oneness and they focus on the love. They realize perfect love casts out all fear. They're not as black and white. So the people that look at this as God's judgment, very much in what M. Scott Peck, the Christian psychiatrist, would call stage two of spiritual growth. So we'll be right back in a second, and we'll talk a little bit more about the hurricanes, God's judgment, debunking some of these preachers, And let's check in if Amy's made it here from Australia, hopefully. Are you here, Amy?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Oh, my God, you're live with us. So we'll be right back, Amy, in 30 seconds to interview you, okay?
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll be right back with Amy Smith from Australia.
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live, and we are live with Amy from Australia. Amy, welcome. This all worked. How did you go? Did you get an email that told you how to connect, or did you call in?
Yes.
How did you get in?
I got the email, got the link, I did the connection. I think there must have just been some lagging or buffering issues. Australian internet, unfortunately, is very slow compared to America and Europe. And, yeah, it's we're the butt of many jokes in internet culture because of that.
Well, I'm so glad you're on. And I hope this isn't a toll call. Then we alluded that, right, hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, I think because it's direct online, yeah, we're fine.
Well, I'm glad I figured this out, too. We have had guests across the pond in England and Europe, but they've always just called. But in your case, I didn't want you to have to pay that, and so I'm glad we figured this out. Amy, tell us how the Pentecostal cult you're involved with, tell us, did you grow up in this, and what was it like?
Yeah, I definitely grew up in it. I was born into it. I had a very young mum. She was only 19, only 3 weeks before her 20th birthday I was born. My dad also was a member. He was a member from about the age of 16, but he was there before it was even there. He was one of the people who'd sort of helped found this non-denominational church. Along with the woman who would eventually become, you know, the leader. He was amongst that sort of that group of teenagers that she was leading in, you know, things like prayer groups and that in different high schools. Because I understand that in America they're not allowed to have government mandated religious programs, but in Australia we have a mandatory 1 hour a week set aside for scripture. So that different kids of different religions, they meet with usually community volunteers to then, you know, teach them about their religion, and then they go back to class. So, mum and dad sort of grew up in that world. They were kids in the 70s and teenagers in the 80s. So in all of that context, by the time I was born, the church had already gone on for about 6 years. So I was born in October 91 in Sydney.
Now, what was it like? What I imagine was pretty sheltered in that kind of mindset. They looked at the world and the things of the secular culture as dangerous or evil, I would imagine. So was your culture pretty sheltered or limited to like a Christian subculture?
Yeah, in yes and no. It's kind of bizarre because there was that very sort of charismatic lean, with quite a dash Pentecostal. There was that sort of desire to evangelize. So they did see the need to be out in the world, and they were very involved in the local community. They also had a very much a belief that they needed to be influential in things like, you know, local government and that sort of thing. So even if they weren't directly involved in politics, they would certainly help out in the community. But it was always through a filter that we were the ones who had the truth and everyone else was outside of it. And that, or even if they had the truth, they didn't have all the truth like we did. So it, So it's still, so even though we did get to interact quite a lot with people on the outside, it was always through a certain filter that while it didn't physically isolate us, it psychologically sort of isolated us.
So there's all this always this binary of us and them. You were the saved, they were the lost, you had the truth. Even other churches maybe weren't quite on your level. There was this elitism in that that regard, huh?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was a shame because it didn't start out that way. It, you know, had started out, you know, it's just very passionate youth who sort of, they came out of an era, like, sort of in, to give you some context, like, because obviously we're talking about, you know, very different countries here, very different approaches to life in general, let alone faith. In Australia, we had a sort of a charismatic revival in the 1970s in a lot of the mainline churches. And while most of the people stayed within those churches, quite a lot of people also, you know, left those churches and you know, formed groups like the one that I grew up in. And they, so at first there was a bit of a, there was a bit of an ecumenical feel to it. And some of, and there was some ecumenical activity that occurred in my own childhood, but as time went on, that became less and less. And as we became more fortified in many ways in our mindsets. But I even look at early on, even with all of that, there was still a very full-on way of doing faith. I mean, I remember 94 was the year that the Toronto Blessing happened. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. I was actually had visited up there when that was going on, yeah.
Yeah, and that obviously had a huge effect on many in the charismatic and Pentecostal movements in the English-speaking world, particularly the Commonwealth. It's kind of funny. Like, things were a bit delayed for America. The full effects of it weren't really felt until sort of the mid-noughts, but in Australia, the effects were almost immediate. And I think part of that was because that we were coming up to the millennium, and and in the year 2000, our city, Sydney, we hosted the Olympics, and that was seen as, you know, by a lot in the charismatic movement, my group in, included, as a very ripe opportunity to evangelize.
Yeah. And how did it get more cult-like? What were some of the signs to you that it was getting more weird?
That's interesting because there were signs even early on, but because the incidents were rather small, it was put down to the teething problems of a new church that had only been founded in 1985. There were concerns early on from some of the parents because the majority of the first generation members, that being the people who converted and joined, they're all in the majority of them are in high school. And so, of course, the parents were very worried about that because this was only seven or 8 years after Jonestown had happened. And, that was all
predominantly. People were very paranoid about following a cult leader at that time.
Yeah, they were, very much so, and especially if they drew in a lot of young members. There was, like, I can even say that the circumstances of my own birth were rather, were an indicator that things weren't always that great, because my mum, she had me outside of wedlock. It was a boy in her youth group, and he wasn't, you know, by the time I was born, he was not in the picture at all. The pastor basically humiliated her emotionally. And my mom
was
made to
feel very... Was it a shaming, Amy, like that she was a sinner or a fornicator, that type of mindset?
Oh, yeah. You know, and other things as well about the social, like the social implications of it. You know, what are other churches? Because at this point they were still involved in, very much involved with the community. They said, you know, what are the other churches going to think? There was that sort of mindset. And because there were some suspicions around the group already by this point. I think And I think it's but because I think, you know, Mum did sort of internalize a lot of that, she, you know, she just went, she endured it. And, you know, she ended up, you know, marrying my dad, who's an amazing person. But what ended up happening was, like, over time, yeah, it would be incrementally, things would get more and more controlling. I remember as a child, I was not allowed, you know, to enjoy certain things that a lot of my peers got to enjoy because of the content in the media. And
yeah,
which
for
is something
example,
I mentioned.
What were some of the rules of things that were bad or satanic in their mindset?
Well, things like I had to stop watching Captain Planet, even though it was one of my most favorite shows. I used to watch it with my friends at preschool, and we used to recreate it the day after watching each episode. I mean, that was how we sort of played. Couldn't keep watching that because apparently that was too new age. You know, things like Care Bears, My Little Pony, and then, of course, later on, there would be things like the Harry Potter series and even some science fiction. Dungeons and Dragons was out of the question.
Yeah.
There was just all of that, yeah.
So the Pentecostals are really afraid if you watch something like Harry Potter, they believe it's a plot to train children to become witches and warlocks.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I still don't read Harry Potter and all that, but that's not because of those beliefs. It's because of the fact that when I did read it a little bit, but because I wasn't allowed to be around it when I was a kid and grow up with it, like everyone else of my generation did, I couldn't appreciate it in the same way that a lot of my peers can. And so, you know, it's just like, so even now it has that sort of effect on me, even though I don't have the superstition around it. It's like I can't really have the appreciation.
Yeah, it's almost like you missed out on the emotional connection of coming of age or being a child when it was big. You kind of miss that, you know. Like I look at periods of my life when I was in fundamentalism and my wife and I were met at a Bible school that was very legalistic and you weren't allowed to go to movie theaters. In fact, we almost broke up over the movie Footloose because we weren't allowed to see movies, and I snuck off and saw Footloose. And I told her, this movie is just like the church and the school we're going to. There's this controlling preacher, and he won't let you dance, because we got in trouble for dancing at the school. And if, you know, she was like, oh, my God, you've given over to Satan. I don't know if I should stay with you. But there's a whole period when you're in that environment, and it feels like you almost miss out on the whole cultural experience, you know, because you're in this whole other subculture world. So did you feel like you, in a way, you missed out on childhood in certain ways?
I think, even putting aside some of the cultural stuff, just how we were treated, there's something I always say about that group and groups like it, is that the kids were never able to be children and the adults were never able to grow up.
Wow.
That really
sums profound. I want to repeat that. The kids were not able to be kids and the adults were not able to grow up. So the adults that are attracted to a cult like this, they're in many ways immature and need that parent figure, which is the parent figure, which is like the cult leader, becomes like that, almost like that father or that mother in a way that tells you what's right and wrong.
Which makes a lot of sense, considering a lot of the people who joined, they came from rather either troubled family backgrounds, or they had that very, you know, we had the veneer of respectability that's so typical in suburbia, but behind closed doors, things aren't that great. And that was very much the dynamic for the majority of the people who joined, especially in the first generation. You know, my own mom had a very fraught relationship with her parents because their marriage was absolutely terrible at the time, and they divorced in the 90s. And my mom said it was a relief when they did, because, and she wished they did it earlier, because it was very difficult to grow up in that kind of home. Yeah, my dad, he was the only practicing Christian for the longest time in his family when he, you know, converted, because he came from a more agnostic background. So he couldn't really connect with his parents on issues of faith. So, of course, he looked for a parental figure for his spirituality. And and the leader, I think, and that's the thing, because the leader herself came from a troubled background. Her father was a World War II veteran, and of course, being the 1950s, you just didn't talk about it. And so, of course, like a lot of the ex-veterans, he drank, and that caused issues in her home. So there are all these these people from these troubled backgrounds, and of course, they were attracted to the leader because she seemed to provide a rather maternal way. But then over time, that like at first she you know, from everything my parents said, I don't really remember because I wasn't around, but from everything I was told, she was a very kind, you know, maternal woman. But then over time, it just, she became stricter and stricter. Obviously, there were these underlying things that weren't obvious. Then when she became leader, that sort of brought it all to the fore. And I think what was really hard was the fact that, of course, my family, along with other families, they were looking to, you know, have a more Christian way of being family, to fix the problems what happened with their families. But in doing so, unfortunately, ended up hurting us kids too, because I mentioned this. I've mentioned this in other times that I've talked about this, because I've done a couple of public speaking things about this, that they did use corporal punishment on children. And that included the use of sticks, you know, the whole twitch the back of the legs sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that has always been, I think that was always the biggest one that was always hardest for me to get over.
Yeah, there's a real emphasis in these groups in corporal punishment. In my young adult years, I was the pastor of a Pentecostal church that had a lot of similarities. But I was always against the corporal punishment of children, never spanked our own son and daughter. And I started to get really persecuted within that world that I was a bad dad. And our kids have turned out great. But at the time, everyone was into this thing, this book by James Dobson. And there's a chapter in the book that talked about the household instruments that are great for spanking, the spatulas and the, you know, the different boards. And I would see kids that would play with our kids or be in the church, and they'd have these marks on them, you know, on their legs or whatever. And I started to confront the parents and, threaten to report these people. And they would say, oh, no, this is spare the rod, spoil the child. It's biblical. And, you know, to them it's very ungodly if you don't beat the kids.
Yes. Yeah, and that's exactly what they very much believed, that it was ungodly to not spank children. We had the Michael and Debbie Pearl books for us.
What was the name of the books you had?
Michael and Debbie Pearl. I think you'd be very familiar with them in America.
Oh, okay. No Greater Joy Ministries?
Yes.
Yeah. There have been a lot of people that have beat the kids bad, that it traces back to the Pearl's teachings, people that have read their books.
Yes.
I've heard people allege that.
Yes, and I think the problem was, you know, some of the parents, of course, because what was happening was a lot of the root issues of them and having trouble with their own family histories and that. These were people who were still very affected by the dynamics in their dysfunctional backgrounds. And so as a result, this sort of thing only made things worse for their future family dynamics, because of course not only is it the corporal punishment, it's the controlling mindset that goes behind it. And I think that's why, unfortunately, I have two younger sisters. One of them was born after my family was out of that place. The other one was born in 98, and so she and I were raised in that context. And between the two of us, I was the one who did get spanked more. And I'm not saying, you know, oh, because my parents are horrible people. My parents are lovely people. And it was only when they were in that place that they ever did this sort of thing, because they were taught that this was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I was the one who got spanked more, because I had, well, what they thought was a lot of behavioral problems. We since, you know, figured out that it was actually because I had undiagnosed autism spectrum disorder. And so, of course, you can understand that a lot of the ways that autistic children communicate and behave is very different to how a neurotypical person would communicate and behave. So a lot of the things I was doing was put down to disobedience and bad behavior. And it actually, you know, delayed a lot of the process of my parents, you know, sort of being able to find answers as to why I behaved the way I did, because it was put, you know, the group would put it down to, you know, spank your child. She'll obey you. She'll listen to you.
Yeah, and you tie together the word controlling with the corporal punishment, and I think that's a brilliant, brilliant insight that you have, Amy, because in the fundamentalism and the Pentecostalism world like that, children are to be controlled. Children are to be seen and not heard. They're, you know, rather than treating them the way Jesus said, that unless you become like a child and valuing them, that they have this great dignity and treating them as people, it's, you know, I remember a pastor rebuking me because I wasn't spanking my kids. They were having fun running around. He's like, can't you keep your kids under control? I remember if I heard that once, I heard that many times.
Yeah.
You know, can't you control your kids? Because my kids were just full of life and they weren't so repressed like all the other church girls in their long dresses. And I raised them to be strong and critical thinkers and spunky. And and so, you know, I remember I was in that world and I was indoctrinated, but I was questioning and I was not fully taking everything authority said. Were you compliant and believing it all at one point, or were you questioning all along? And how did you get empowered to start questioning this whole group? And is it right? And was it, you know, when you hit your teen years, you started thinking for yourself, or how did you start to challenge things?
Well, yeah. So I just went, you know, went through primary school, yeah, and just took for granted, you know, everything that we did in the group, because we encountered a lot of other churches and groups who were very similar to us. You know, very charismatic, very Pentecostal, evangelical sort of, you know, sort of churches and groups. I just kind of took for granted that that's what real Christianity was as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, like, even with all of that going on, there were still a lot of positives. You know, we got involved in more community events, et cetera. But what was happening was I entered high school. I was in a public primary school. But because I had such a rough time there, I was a target for bullying in primary school. It only reinforced a lot of my attitudes about, you know, the world outside of Christianity. All these kids are not Christians, and by Christians I meant my type of Christian. That's why they're behaving this way. That's why they're such awful people. But once I went into high school, I met a whole lot of people who were really lovely. And again, this is a public high school, and that is when I really started to question things, because it just didn't make sense. This was a post 9/11 world. I started high school in 2004 in Australia. Grade 7 is when high school starts. So we don't do middle school here in Australia. Primary school is K to 6, and then 7 to 12 is high school. So I enter year 7 and it's 2004, so 9/11 had happened, and we were very much like hearing stuff about, you know, about Muslims, and it went beyond theological objection and went straight into fear, hostility, and even outright bigotry about Muslims, conspiracy theories and whatnot. And then 2004 was also quite a political year. That was when the American elections were happening, and Massachusetts had put through, you know, same-sex marriage. That was the first, I think that was one of the first states to do it. And then of course, there was the U.S. election where, you know, our group was very much a fan of George W. Bush. And then in Australia, we also had a federal election for the Prime Minister, and our Prime Minister at the time was a conservative Prime Minister by the name of John Howard. And that year he had just brought in a law that actively excluded any marriage outside of that between a man and a woman. And so because of all of that, we talked a lot about a lot about these issues, you know, through that lens. And yeah, just some of the ways that they talked about these issues was just very, very hostile, very, very narrow. And I questioned, after that, you know, I questioned a lot of that because I was meeting people who were Muslim, who were gay, who were Christians that weren't from the world of the Pentecostal, charismatic, evangelical sort of bent. And I just realized, yeah, something's off. Something is very off here because there's a disconnect between what they're stating and what reality is.
Well, that took a lot of courage for you to choose reality rather than the indoctrination, because a lot of people are so deeply entrenched that it's very, very hard to get them to look at the reality. I mean, one of the things I began to see was in that binary in which the worldview, we're the saved and all these other people are lost and wrong that don't think and believe and behave as we do. And the mindset is we're the ones with the Holy Spirit and the fruit of the Spirit. And then what do you do when you see people in the world that are nicer, that have more love, joy, peace, patience?
Yes.
And the Christians or the people within the narrow cult are not nice, Christ-like people, then something's not working. Reality is not supporting, you know, the worldview that they've taught us is not conforming to reality, because the Christians aren't the shimmering, nice, angelic people, and the world aren't all evil, satanic people.
That's where it all started. And I think that's the thing. My parents started noticing this too. And you know, I was reading the Bible a bit more, and I started having a lot of questions because, of course, a lot of it didn't make sense. And the filter through which the group was saying things just made it even more confusing. So there was this constant cycle of, I have objections to the things the group's saying, well, go read the Bible. Okay, I've read the Bible, but it just makes me more confused. Well, that's your problem. And my parents and I had a lot of fights at that time, because I was starting to vocalize a lot of these questions. I'm like, there's stuff that's not making sense. And then I started noticing, from about the year 2001, we started having mass exoduses, you know, entire families leaving. And so, of course, I'm going, what's happened with them, though? Like, that was really sudden. They're gone all of a sudden. What's going on? And it was just like, oh, hush, no, don't talk about it. You know, and it's like, why? Why not? What's going on? Why are they leaving? And the answers, if I was given any answers, were very unsatisfactory. It just didn't ring true. And so I very...
Do you remember any of their explanations of what they said? Did they demonize the people that leave? Because that's a typical technique in these groups, is the people that left have committed blasphemy, or they're not walking with Christ, you know.
Yeah, it was quite subtle with some of them. They would be like, they just seem to have become more lukewarm in their faith lately. They just changed their view on some of the aspects of the faith. That's something I learned since. But it just, again, it didn't ring true, because these people would sometimes be in the leadership positions within the group. So there was this disconnect. Again, there was this constant disconnect between what the group was saying and what the reality was. And even though with my autism, I can find it difficult to read situations non-verbally unless it's explained to me in full, I could see that there was that disconnect. And so because in my mind, you know, because of the way my brain works, I wasn't getting explanations. I was getting very frustrated. And I started realizing more and more that the group was not safe for me to ask questions because of that, because I knew that if I went any further with the questioning, you know, to the leaders, that I could get in trouble. I even heard some of the families that had left, you know, some of the things that were said about them, suddenly the subtlety was gone and it was just outright nasty. Oh, they're involved with witchcraft. They've backslidden completely, none of which was true. And so, of course, this just created nothing but confusion for me, and I hated it because I needed answers.
Yeah, the binary mindset where everything's split into extreme black or white, it's almost like they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So a person's either all with God or all with Satan, so that if they leave the church, then it makes sense according to the cult worldview that anyone that leaves us is into witchcraft and they're following the devil and they're a Judas. It reaches that point where they have to demonize the people that left. Now, at some point, did you become the demonized one? Did you become the bad girl that's questioning too much? And how did it reach that level?
Ironically, through a lot of the arguing that my parents are having with me, what I didn't realize was that they were asking a lot of the same questions I was asking. And because, of course, they were involved in leadership positions, my mom ran a ministry, and my dad was one of the elders for a few years. They already were asking a lot of these questions, and they were asking them even more deeply because they were witnessing these things more directly. And so when they, a lot of what our arguments were was stemmed from them being very afraid for me because of the fact that I was asking a lot of the same questions they were, and they were already starting to be punished for that. And they did not want me to land in the same boat. So them trying to, you know, sort of shut me down from asking those questions was actually their way, a sort of a roundabout way of them trying to protect me without realizing it. And I thank God that they were like that. I think it came very close when I started experimenting more with my fashion. I hung out mostly by the time I was in year nine, so grade nine, so about 14, 15. I hung out with a lot of the alternative girls, and at the time, you know, so the emo fashion and metal fashion was very popular amongst the alternative kids at my school. So I started experimenting more with my fashion, you know, wearing checkered socks and black dresses and even like a rainbow shirt with it. Like I was a bit wacky with my style. The leaders weren't happy about that. And my parents knew that. And so they made sure that I was never brought into any kind of meeting with those leaders because they knew that if I was, that they would browbeat me until I, you know, was more conformist in my appearance and less experimental. And I actually had an interaction with the pastor who turned around and said to me, oh, it's nice that you dress, you know, in a very sort of trendy or experimental, I forgot the term that she used, you know, sort of way. And she goes, not with the sort of gothic stuff, but we'll work on that. That was the closest I ever came because my mum and dad made sure that never happened. And they were being punished more and more as time went on. My mum had her ministry removed from her because of insubordination. And my dad.
What was your mum's ministry?
She was the dance choreographer because we had a dance ministry. Of course, charismatic Pentecostals, so charismatics really love the use of dance and banners and all that sort of thing
dancing,
to express worship.
Yeah.
And mom had a dance background, so
that's what she was
sort of in charge of.
Well,
yeah,
that was really using her talents. Now, you haven't mentioned the group. I'm assuming you don't want to, and I wouldn't pressure you to. Would you rather keep the name silent or?
For a few different reasons. I'll list off the reasons why. One of them being that I don't want any people of faith listening to this and going, well, that was their issue. No, that's an issue that unfortunately is all too common in too many Christian circles. So I don't want someone going, that's someone else's problem, because that's a lot of different groups' problems. Another one being, I do have younger sisters, and I do have my parents. I don't care about any kind of possible backlash that could happen to me, but I do care about what happens to my family. So I keep everything anonymous in that regard, in terms of their names and all that sort of thing. And also for me, it's also about taking ownership of my story. You know, for so long, it was all about them and what I had to do for them. So for me, I just feel like I don't want to give them the credit I want to give myself, my faith, and God the credit for what has happened in my life. And also, I don't want to...
I love the fact you thought through all these reasons. Is it a big group, a small group, and what happened
small,
to the group? Is it
very
it's small. A small group?
Yeah, they started out, they were rather medium-sized, so about, 100 to 200 members by the time I was born. And then by the time my family were kicked out, it was, about 60 or less, and now it's about 30. It's gotten very low, but it's very, still very fortified in their mindset and their thinking.
Do you have any comment? Do you have any comment? You don't have to comment, but do you have any comment on the Hillsong group in Australia?
I don't have much to comment about there because I don't have much experience with them. I do take issue, obviously, with the prosperity gospel that is so common to mega churches like Hillsong. I have heard that their early days were very parallel to the days of what things are like in my group. But like I said, I don't have much experience with Hillsong
myself. I was thinking there were parallels in the early days of their group, and you're both in Australia. In their case, they've come up on our show because Justin Bieber's got involved with them. And also, they had some pedophile background that they tried to cover up for a while. The founder, Frank Houston.
We have what's called a Royal Commission going on in Australia. It has been going on for a few years now. And pretty much every single church and denomination in this country has been under scrutiny. This has been a rather brutal cleansing, if you will. Of the temple because of just how many organizations and institutions, not just churches, but we're even talking swimming coaches and scouts as well and schools,
it's
all
so
being
sad.
Investigated. Yeah, it is.
So sad,
Australians already have a very, because of our colonial history, we already have a very deep-seated mistrust of authority and an institution, and I think instances like this is only reinforcing a lot of that, in good ways and bad ways. There can be a danger of overcorrecting itself, but in many ways, it was long overdue, for all of the churches to be under scrutiny for their responses to cover up abuse.
Well, what an insight historically to going back to your colonial period in the late 1700s through the 1900s. Well, you made an interesting journey in getting your faith back in a journey towards the Catholic Church. Can you share with us about that? And what drew you to the Catholic Church? I know the Catholic Church isn't perfect and has had its scandals as well, but
as one
raised Catholic myself, I'm very curious. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think after coming through kind of a fly-by-night Pentecostal group, the fact the Catholic Church is the oldest organized church or has a couple thousand years of history, that was, I would think, might be one of the appeals because they've been around so long and they're not like some group that's just around one little cult leader, one small cult leader.
Exactly. Because the leaving process of my family was very brutal. I mean, we literally had no choice. We were all kicked out because it just, the leaders were just sick and tired of all the questioning and they wanted to get rid of us as soon as, in any way they could. But
Did they give any specific reason, Amy, or was it just that you and your family were asking too many questions in the Pentecostal cult? Or did they say it's because of this? Or was just like they were tired of you guys asking too many questions?
The real reason was that they were tired of us guys asking too many questions. The reason they gave the congregation was that we were, this was through someone who, claimed to have a rather, a direct word from God about this, that we had friends outside of the group who were Christians, who were involved with witchcraft, and that we were drawing others into that knowingly. And so that was the the duplicitous nature of this group, that there was always a real reason and a reason they gave the congregation, which was never the real reason. So rather than them, so we started realizing there wasn't just that they're in this mindset of, you know, oh, they're backslidden because they're not part of it. It's like they also knowingly spread lies about my family. The pastor even tried to contact other ministers in the area because of the previous ecumenical works that the old group had done. You know, my parents were rather well connected with the ministers in the area. The pastor even tried to go to at least a couple of the other ministers in the area to tell them to not accept my family into their churches. Now, of course, they turned around and said, your authority isn't has no meaning here because I'm the pastor of this church, not you. And they were very concerned when that happened because they'd heard, you know, through the grapevine about what had happened. They thought, oh, surely that can't be true. And then when that happened with the pastor, they were very concerned for us. So we were really lucky as a family that we were surrounded by such lovely people who were very kind-hearted Christians. So for me, a lot of my loss of faith was not so much a loss of belief in God. It was a loss of faith in people. I had a deep-seated mistrust of people that took years to regain. And I had a loss of trust in my own judgments, because the person who had sort of fed the lie to my old group leaders that, you know, we were involved with someone who was involved with witchcraft was someone that I'd confided in, because they were one of the few people that I felt that I could talk to in that group. So I felt very betrayed. So I did visit churches a little bit for about a year and a half. So we were all kicked out at the end of 2009. I'd just finished high school, and my younger sister was about to enter her last year of primary school. So that's when it all sort of happened. And I visited churches, yeah. So from about start of 2010 to start of 2011. And I then just took a break altogether. I just couldn't really deal with being in church for a while. I even tried to go to a few more, few Pentecostal charismatic churches, obviously, because that was the background I came from, but I realized I actually literally could not handle it. I still can't handle a lot of charismatic contexts, I guess because it just takes me back too much to that time in my life.
What did it feel like when you go in the Pentecostal charismatic circles after escaping the Pentecostal cult? Was it kind of like PTSD, where it brought back negative bad feelings from the past?
I realize that now. At the time, I didn't realize it, but yeah, I very much, you know, my heart was thumping. My heart would thump. There'd be a lump in my throat, and I would have to breathe very deeply in order to get through it. And the whole time there were knots in my stomach. And these would even be at ones where my friends would be at, where I knew that the people who ran the place were good people. This was still a safe group. But because of the style of worship, it just brought back too many triggers. And so I realized more and more that the Pentecostal charismatic spirituality just wasn't for me.
I think like with PTSD too, your rational mind can know, like a soldier that was, say, in Vietnam, he can know, you know, I'm home with my mother in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm not in Vietnam. His rational mind knows that, but if something triggers the memory, you know, he's feeling the fear and the hypervigilance and the, you know, the anxiety of being in Vietnam. So even though you know it's a safe group, if it's reminding you of that group, you can feel that old feeling, that old anxiety.
Yeah, so when I did start looking again, I was in a serious relationship, and you know, even though that didn't eventuate into anything like marriage or anything, it did make me think about, you know, what am I doing with my life right now, and how do I get into my future. I was sort of thinking about my future a lot more. I think by this point I was 21, 22, and so of course at that age you do start thinking more about what you want for your life. And I decided to start looking into going to church again. And I made sure that I looked for a few things. I wanted, for starters, a denominational structure that had external authority figures outside of the particular church that I would attend. And that was important to me because I wanted it that if anything would occur, if any problems were to arise, I knew that there was someone else I could go to who was even higher than, say, the pastor or the minister of that church that could deal with the issue. I also wanted to make sure that the church that I was a part of had some historical roots, you know, beyond the 20th century, because a lot of the denominations that had been founded in the last 100 or 150 years, the more I researched, were just very problematic, you know, too easy to get into that cult of personality like I had with my old group. And too involved in each other's politics and trying to figure out what exactly the vision of the church is. And usually churches that are older have already got all that sorted out. But I didn't actively seek the Catholic Church at all, whatsoever. Quite the opposite. I wanted to avoid it because I thought that the whole idea of there being a pope was just, oh, that's just a cult then, but bigger. I didn't understand how it actually all worked. I looked into older liturgical churches, like the Anglicans, I even briefly looked into Orthodox. I loved the spirituality of the Orthodox and the fact that it is one of the churches that can be traced back to the time of the apostles as I started reading more in church history. It was a couple of different books actually that really made me realize, oh, I actually, like, I really should look more into the Catholic Church, as well as a particular person. The first book was a wonderful book, and I highly recommend this book to your readers. It is written by a woman in California, I hope she gets a chance to hear the show, actually, because I want her to know, like, just how much of an impact this work that she wrote had on someone on the other side of the world. Her name is Elizabeth Esther, and she grew up in California with a group called The Assembly, and she wrote a book called Girl at the End of the World. And this was the first book from someone, a first-hand account of someone who grew up in a cult that I could relate to, because she actually was born and raised in it. Every other account that I'd read were people who had joined, you know, groups like mine. So they were adults the whole time. They couldn't relate to what my particular struggle was, which was how do you navigate, how do you start again? How do you start your whole life again? And Elizabeth Esther's Girl at the End of the World really moved me, because it articulated in ways that I couldn't for myself why I was feeling the way I was feeling, why my life felt so off, why everything, you know, was so confusing after leaving. And then I found out, coincidentally, that she herself decided to go with the Catholic Church. And so then from there I read a lot of the works of Dr. Scott Hahn, particularly Rome Sweet Home. He had a very rigid Calvinist approach to theology.
Yes,
before.
Scott, I know Scott. In fact, my show started on terrestrial radio. Now we're on the internet. And you can hear us in Australia there. But I started on a terrestrial radio station, WPITFM, in Pittsburgh, about an hour and a half from where he teaches at Steubenville. So he was on my show several times talking theological stuff. So I know Scott.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's wonderful. Yeah, reading his works, I always love that he can blend writing about theology in a lovely sort of grandfatherly manner. It's such a lovely manner that in which he writes. And so it was a gentle approach to theology. This is someone who is enthusiastic and loves theology, and he can convey that well to people through his style. He's the sort of person I can imagine, like, the sort of, you know, would love to sit down with you with, you know, a cup of coffee and a chat. Like, that was the sort of impression I got from reading his books. And so when he explained how a lot of the issues of authority worked within the Catholic Church, it made me realize that it was not the same as what I had grown up with at all. You know, maybe in the medieval times it would have been a bit, you know, full on, but it was always meant to be, you know, very, it was always meant to be there to make it easier for people of faith to follow. You know, you could be the most illiterate person in the world, or you could be the most learned person in the world, and there's always a place for you in the Catholic Church, because it's not entirely reliant on, here we have a Bible, we're basing everything on the Bible, but actually we're just basing everything in our interpretation of the Bible. It's more about, you know, it's not just about the Bible, it's how you live your faith. How do you live that out? And I haven't seen that emphasized in many other churches like that.
Well, let's get to that question. And I want to ask, how has your view of people in the world changed? You grew up in a church where they demonized you if you left. They called you a witch, basically. You're in witchcraft, like the Salem witch trials, where you demonized the people. And now they're only people that you sought to convert when you were in the cult. Has your ability to get along with people outside of your circle now become better because you're no longer looking at them as, you know, the terrible people that are outside the cult and need to be saved? How has your view also of secular culture changed because you no longer feel probably that Satan will get you if you watch the old Captain America or Captain, I forget what the cartoon was, Captain Environment.
Yeah, oh, Captain Planet. Yeah, Captain Planet,
that
yeah.
was it. So, you know, everything was evil and all the cartoons are demonic. So has your view of secular culture and art and entertainment changed? Has your view of the people around you changed? And how's it made your life different?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I very much was, you know, very, very much feeling that, you know, all of these people are lost and we have to convert them all and, you know, they're all going to go to hell. And there was always this neuroticism about hell and the afterlife. My view of people, yeah, definitely changed over time. It took time because, again, I had a lot of trust issues after, you know, leaving, after being kicked out of the cult, because I thought, well, when people would try and make friends with me, my first thought would be, you know, not only because I'm someone who has autism spectrum disorder, thus making friends can already be a little more difficult, but also the fact that, yeah, this had all happened to me. Anytime people would make friends with me, my first thought would be, what's in it for you? What's in it for you? Like, what are you getting out of this? What are you going to get out of me? And so I did have my walls up for a while, but I got involved with a, it's now closed down, but there was a community-run cafe that, you know, helped a lot of local artists and that sort of thing. And it was a social enterprising sort of cafe. So everyone who was there, it wasn't customers and waiters. It was, you know, it was guests and hosts, really. It was lovely. And so there was it was the first time since there I got to experience a healthy community. And so that really helped me sort of change my views. And a lot of the people there were Christian, very down-to-earth sort of Christians. And a lot of them didn't attend church because they had a lot of issues with church as well. And so they really helped me see different ways of approaching life and faith. Through that, I just also sort of somehow, like, of course, you know, I was still, you know, connected with some of my old friends from high school, and they sort of helped me transition out very well. I did get a bit reckless. I think because I was so deeply traumatized in the first 2 years after leaving, I did drink very heavily on Friday and Saturday nights, be it going to friends' places, pubs, or out to the city. There was always something done on a Friday and Saturday night, and I'd always come home pretty much plastered, because for me, it was a mix of me wanting to celebrate now being old enough to do all that sort of thing now that I was 18 years old, and also the fact that I no longer had my life controlled. So while it wasn't entirely healthy, it still, you know, sort of helped me sort of go headlong into the world. But I, after all of that sort of calmed down, and even in more recent, you know, times, a couple of different things really also helped. And my newfound faith has meant that I can have a very relaxed approach to faith, you know, while still, you know, being devout. Because I think it's just, I don't know, it must be something just inbuilt into me to still have that strong belief in God and desire to practice that. and seek the heart of God. And yet it's done in such a gentle way in the Catholic faith, and that really helped too. And as well, I'm very involved with the autistic community, online and offline. I'm doing a disability studies course at university in the hope that I can work with other people on the spectrum. And as well as also being very involved in the goth scene in Sydney, because there is still a goth scene in Sydney. A lot of people think that they all kind of died away at the end of the 90s, but they're still going strong. And some of the people there are some of the best friends you could ever imagine. Very kind people, and we all look out for each other. So all of that combination of all that really helped me change a lot of my view of the world, that there are a lot of good, kind people. And I think to me now, I sort of view it as, well, God made all of these people. So and so of course, there is going to be good, kind people, even if they don't necessarily believe in him. God still made them, and thus he makes what he makes is good.
Yes, and they're all created in God's image. And wow, we've ran out of time. It's like Einstein said, time is relative, and it goes by so quick when there's a great, interesting interview like this. But I want to leave you, Amy, and our guests with this quote from Mother Teresa, because I think it fits you in what you're sharing. Mother Teresa said, "I am a little pencil in the hand of a writing God who is sending a love letter to the world." So you're sending a love letter to the world by sharing your story. And you got into a saint of the Divine Mercy, if I remember right, didn't you?
Yes, Faustina. Saint Faustina ended up becoming my confirmation saint. Reading the Divine Mercy, as soon as I came across that, it was emotional, very emotional. It's helped me in my own process of forgiving the people who hurt my family and myself, as well as, you know, just realizing just how kind and merciful God is to us. You know, he of how he got my family through everything. You know, and we are such different people now. All of my family are such different people compared to how we were, you know, 7-8 years ago. And thank God for that, because we're
better
people.
That's a great note to end on. Faustina said that Jesus spoke to her and said, "I am love and mercy itself." And that was kind of, as we were waiting to connect with you, I was trying to share with our listeners, because we've been through these devastating hurricanes, and some of the fundamentalist preachers were shaming the people in Florida and Texas and saying it's because you're terrible sinners and he hates you and he's mad and he's punishing you. And what a great note to end on, because I wanted them to know, no, that's not true. And God is love and mercy itself.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
Oh, well, I'm glad it worked out. I'm elated that we figured it out and it worked out. And by the way, Amy and all of our listeners, just so you all know, this link of the show is good in perpetuity for replay. So the same link, you can listen to the show and anytime for people that missed it live.
Wonderful.
God bless you across the pond. I hope you can come back and share further updates on your journey in the future, Amy.
Oh, thank you so much. God bless you too.
And God bless all of you for listening, and tune into our next show on Saturday. This Saturday, 11 a.m. Pacific time, that will be 2 p.m., those of you in the East Coast. And it's this Saturday, the 16th, 11 a.m. Crystal, who wrote the book Waking Up in Heaven. She's a teacher. She's a mother. And my aunt, when I was in Florida visiting her before the hurricane, I guess I was kind of fortunate I wasn't there for the hurricane. I was there before that, and I got back. But Waking Up in Heaven, Crystal McVeigh is a mother, a teacher. I believe she's in Oklahoma. She had some medical problems, was dead for, I think, 9 minutes. She's going to describe her 9-minute journey into heaven. She says she woke up in heaven. And it's quite a remarkable story. So tune in Saturday for that, and thank you for listening. Go with God and be blessed, and I appreciate your support of the show. And all of our friends and family in Florida, we're so glad you're safe. Just hang in there until you get all your power back on. We love you. Bye-bye.